ticklish business any way you look at it. Come on, we'll stick together.
It's Ticklish Business, the podcast devoted to honoring and deconstructing the world of classic cinema. As always, I'm your host, Kristen Lopez. This week's mini-sode contains my interviews with two prominent members of TCM's Trailblazing Women series. Throughout the month of October, every Tuesday and Thursday, TCM honors the work of the actresses who shaped Hollywood while contributing to causes outside the industry. In my first interview, you'll hear my talk with historian and Mary Pickford expert Carrie Beecham. Afterwards, listen to me speak to Trailblazing Women host Ileana Douglas.
I'm good. How are you?
I'm fine. I mean, I'm glad to, you know, do anything on this thing because I do love, I never was crazy about the phrase Trailblazing Women, but I mean, I'm glad for the dedicated focus, let's say.
You know, you're a frequent friend of TCM, and this is your second time with the Trailblazing Women series. Other than TCM calling you and saying, hey, we want you to do this, what enticed you about the series?
Well, I mean, last year, you know, doing directors was a lot of fun and working on just putting the spotlight on people who are normally not even mentioned. And if they are mentioned, it's at the bottom of the paragraph, you know what I mean? And being able to really spell out the importance of these women as links in a chain. This year, it was supposed to be actresses who made a difference, looking outside as much, looking at their impact on things besides their impact as actresses on the screen. The night that I'm doing the first night is start. Fortunately, the TCM people, you know, ask me what I think about this and that, and which people, it's a pleasure to be able to have input into that and suggest different people. But they were the ones, I have to say, who, while it would have been my choice, they made the choice too, that Mary Pickford would be the first of the over 30 actresses to be highlighted here, because what impresses me so much about Mary Pickford is she did it all without any path to follow. No one else had come before her, and not just as incredible star on the screen, but as a businesswoman who knew when it was time to start United Artists, keep control over her career, who was one of three women in the founding, the first 30-something who founded the Academy. And also, I think most importantly to her, the founder of what would become the Motion Picture Television Fund.
Last year they did directors, which I think a lot of people, when we talk about women in the industry, you know, that seems to be the big thing, is that, you know, we need more female directors, we need more female screenwriters, which is very true. But I think, you know, and I'm one of the few that says, you know, casting diversity is really easy. It's harder to actually get diversity behind the screen. But it's almost as if, you know, actresses kind of get a bum rap when you talk about Trailblazing Women, because it's so easy to cast an actress and kind of say, well, we put a woman in it, it's diverse now.
Well, yeah, I mean, then is so different than now. I mean, Paula Lates. You know, I mean, most of the stars, the real money-making stars for the first 30 years of the century were women, even into the 40s. They carried the movies. We're going to talk about that. The stories were about female protagonists. I mean, Irving Thalberg said, women get men to come to the box, to come to the movies. It's not the other way around.
And that's such a loaded phrase, I think, both positive and negative.
Exactly. But, you know, it's follow the money. So I'm not saying it's, the whole point is it's follow the money then and it's follow the money now. But in the first 35 years of the century, film-wise, the studios believed following the money meant films about female protagonists.
I finally watched, I did a kind of little mini-series on my site about Mary Pickford, because I hadn't actually ever seen any of her movies. So I figured, okay, well, I'll watch it. And it's interesting that we look at, when we talk about the flaws of Hollywood today, it's, you know, I was just arguing with somebody today about how, you know, you get a photo of ensemble cast and it's a bunch of dudes dressed up in regular clothes, and then you have the chick in, you know, booty shorts and a crop top, because
on the far side. I mean, like the green light, when I saw those green light ads, Effie is way over on the side. So we got the one person of color and the one female in one package, and she's on the far side.
Exactly. And you look at Mary Pickford, it's refreshing because even though, you know, you could probably say, okay, well, she still is playing, you know, the innocent little girls and she wasn't allowed to be an adult until much, you know, later in her career. At the same time, I just found it so refreshing that she was able to not have to kind of compromise her integrity in some of these movies.
One is she started playing the girl with the curls in 1917, as it were, the little girl. You know, she always had the curls. But when she started playing the little girl with Poor Little Rich Girl, Rebecca of Sunnybrook Farm, and that whole series of films, before that, she had played matrons. She played Cinderella. She had played Butterfly. She'd played in a whole mess of mothers, wives, girlfriends, whatever. She had played all kinds of roles before, you know, going into that incredibly popular series of Mary as Little Girl films. Now, the thing that I am so pleased about on TCM is that they are screening Little Annie Rooney. And the reason I'm so thrilled about that is that it's recently been restored by the Academy and the Mary Pickford Foundation from an original nitrate print. And you can finally see it is just, you know, it's a pristine print. So my problem with so much of the Mary Pickford material that is out there is that it wasn't restored properly. It kind of jumps around. It can be blurry. This does not promote a clear vision of what Mary could do as an actress.
If you've been on YouTube and you've seen all the Mary Pickford movies that are on there, I forget which is the one I watched, and they had like Pomp and Circumstance playing during a scene because
in between the music, exactly, that they've overlaid, and the quality of what is out there, I mean, it's just so, can be so depressing. So finally, with Little Annie Rooney, not only do we have this incredibly pristine print, but we also have a new score written by a very young man and recorded with a 16-piece orchestra. Relatively modern music written for this film, specifically with a 16-piece orchestra. I mean, so it's, okay, this is the way we are supposed to see them.
Well, it's why everybody goes to TCM, to the film festival, and goes to the silent films.
I'm so pleased that they're going to show this film because it, as I say, it's just pristine, and we've got the right music, and it's just, if you've been forced to go to YouTube, finally, here she is. The other thing about Mary and the characters, I mean, particularly Little Annie Rooney, she had tried to play adult roles, and the fans just clamored for her as a little girl again. And she wrote the story for Little Annie Rooney with screenwriters, but she sat down, as she said, at Pick Fair, we just took some chairs outside and sat around for a few days and hashed out the story. But this character, as well as most of hers, yes, they're spunky, but they all have a backbone. They have a moral compass. And they're not going to, that those characters are never compromised by anything, any larger forces. There's a clarity and a moral compass to every character she plays. You know, it's not sappy. You know what I mean? I mean,
exactly.
You know, she kind of has this image of the sappy little girl. No, there's a backbone, there's a moral compass, and there's a real personality in each one. The other thing to sort of look for in Little Annie Rooney, which I find interesting, is the cast of the neighborhood. It is multi-ethnic beyond anything in films in that day, except for Little Rascals. There's a few typical stereotypes of the time, yes. But the key part of the story is that the neighborhood sticks together, that they all come together at important points. It's an interesting brew of casting. So anyway, that night, start off with Mary. Then we have Dorothy Davenport Reed in Mothers of Men, which is another recently restored. What's interesting about it is it's 1917. They have a woman as governor of California.
Oh, wow.
In California at that time, you could have had a woman governor because we got the vote in California in 1911 before getting the vote nationally in 1920. So it's an important film within the realm of all the suffragette type films that came out in the teens, along with, very crucially, the newsreels that showed the suffragettes that built support for the cause. And Dorothy Davenport Reed, of course, was also featured last year as a director, in part because of prominence as a producer after the death of Wallace Reed and her willingness to take on, you know, social awareness, social subjects that were just normally not touched. And then Lucille Ball and Mary Tyler Moore, both of whom, you know, headed up major corporations. You know, Lucille Ball, good God, comes out here as a golden girl and ends up 30 years later as the head of, you know, this gigantic studio. I think one of the things I learned, which I just loved, was that when they bought RKO and RKO became Desilu, they had something like 39 different sound studios. MGM at the time had something like 35. Wow, huh? How big was this?
You know, I was looking at all the different themes that they're going with for installation of the series, and I think out of all of them, yours is the one that seems the most contained. Everything else seems very broad, you know, and I wanted them to play with it a little bit. I kind of wish they just did a difficult women's section. You know, all the actresses that kind of were pegged.
A lot of these women did create some of their own problems. There's no question about that, right? Part of the reason why you try to separate them out, their work on the screen versus who they were off screen. You know, one of my friends down here, one of the people I work with here is, you know, Elena Archer, who, of course, I know you know.
I've talked to her.
It's challenging. My attitude has to be, this is what we got. This is what we got to work with.
Exactly.
Let's put the focus on it. What is really exciting is, I mean, Bette Midler.
Yes.
I mean, she's a goddess. I adore that woman. I mean, I'm thrilled she's participating.
Jane Fonda?
Yeah, but she's got a long history with the network, let's say. But it was great to have her there, too. And, I mean, it's a great group of women who are joining Ileana this year.
I was going to ask, what was it like for you to... I'm always interested by the mechanics of filming these intros. Because it always looks so organic, you know, like you guys are definitely just talking off the cuff. Do you have talking points that you kind of know you have to hit in these discussions, or is it just kind of a conversation?
I have to say, they're totally, no one tells me what to say. I don't mean that in a proactive way. I'm just saying, no, they don't tell me what to say. They tell me, here are your people. And I'll say, yes, those are my people. No, I know what I want to say about each of them because I tend to feel rather passionately about each of them for different reasons. I prepare, you know, I always say you got to do a lot of homework to look spontaneous. But frankly, I didn't have to do a lot of homework this time because I knew a lot about four of them. Didn't need to do new research into the people. What I needed to do was prioritize in my own mind what the important parts, things I wanted to share with people. And most of all with me, what that is, this is why these people excite me. This is why I think these people are important and deserve our attention.
The most obvious question then is, what defines a quote-unquote trailblazing woman for you?
They need to not only have accomplished, be accomplished women, but one of the reasons why I feel so strongly about it is I think we need to appreciate whose shoulders we're standing on. And these types of programs help us do that. And I find it's crucial to realize we're links in a chain, but we need to understand who else makes up that chain. And these, putting the focus on these women helps us do that. I mean, they are, you know, our foremothers, as it were, and they're the ones who helped get us where we are today. But unless we understand that history, we're not really going to appreciate where we are today.
That's kind of the mentality that I say when people ask about, you know, why should I watch classic cinema? Well, you can't really understand film itself until you've watched stuff that was made before, you know, what the year you were born or anything like that.
But the whole idea of the character development, that the movies that we, going way back, I mean, my goodness, that Alan Dwan, you know, who was a director of both Silence and Sound, said that even when doing sound films, he always watched it once silently. Every sound director to watch their films silently so they could really appreciate the power of the visuals and make sure that that the story was there. The film was really there. It was there silently. The point is that it's a way of double-checking that your story's there, got what you wanted. And then you layer on all these other things. I'll never forget, I just saw a rough cut of the movie The Fugitive, you know, with Harrison Ford, before music was added. And I thought it was a good movie. I mean, and it was certainly well-paced and a bunch of other things. But, whoa, did I appreciate the importance of music when I saw it again. You know what I mean? So each of those things are layered on. So it's not even not without the dialogue, without the music, without everything. I mean, but the visual element has to be there too. Anyway, I mean, I just think there's so much to learn and so much, even more. There's just plain old so much to enjoy.
TCM wouldn't have a festival sell out every year, I think, if people didn't have an interest in classic cinema.
The festival is a little different in the sense of, I mean, it's the joy of, one, seeing them on the big screen, which we don't usually get the opportunity to do, and then that wonderful sense of community of being in a theater with, you know, like-minded people. I mean, last year, I mean, the thrill that still stays with me is even though, you know, we were showing The More the Merrier at 9 in the morning, right? The Egyptian, and I'm going, oh, my God, what are we doing? But, you know, place is packed. It was great. But the joy for me was, you know, going down, sitting in my seat, and, you know, 5 minutes into it, 10 minutes into it, hearing the laughter in the theater. You know, it's just the cacophony of laughter that filled the theater was such a joy. For that sense of community and shared joy was so special. So, I mean, that happens in other films, too, but it just this year, last year, it just particularly struck me during The More the Merrier.
Assuming you'll be at the next year's festival in April, has there been any talks about that?
I'm assuming so. I've been at every single one, thank you, and just enjoy the hell out of it. They certainly haven't told me I'm not. So, I mean, it's funny you ask because I thought, oh my gosh, I didn't think to ask. I've just been kind of working. I wrote down the dates and excited about it. Of course, I live in Los Angeles, so it's not like I have to book any flights or hotel rooms, right?
You're the lucky one, exactly. I was fortunate to go to the panel you did last year at TCM on my first time in Hollywood. I got to sit by Nancy Olsen. She sat next to me, and I was so starstruck. I was like, this is why I steal these front seats, because they always put somebody really cool next to me.
She's wonderful.
The Trailblazing Women series, they liked it enough to bring it back for a second go-round.
They're doing a third year. They've committed all along to 3 years.
But what is the hope for you, at least, for the series? Is it just that it will hopefully increase awareness of the actresses and the movies picked? Or do you hope that there's a broader, a grander scheme to it all?
That alone is more than most, you know, people would pay attention to. So, right. I mean, I'm just thrilled that they're kind of stopping and pausing and saying, no, these are people worth paying attention to. These are not always my favorite movies that are attached to these actresses, I must say. But, you know, there's always a question of licensing and what else has been played lately and things like that, all of which is totally understood. But the women themselves, I'm thrilled that they're putting the focus on them. You know, movies themselves, of course, are, you know, the most collaborative art form you can have. So anytime you can kind of appreciate that while also standing back and saying, wait a second, you know, now let's look at the editors. Now let's look at the writers. Now let's look at other branch it is, as it were. You know, I think it's an opportunity to learn more about filmmaking. It's an opportunity to look at it through a slightly different lens. I mean, when you look at a film through an editor's eyes, you see it a lot differently than you would through, you know, the casting director's eyes or whatever. It's a chance to look at these films in a slightly different way. Appreciate them in a slightly different way, and that's important. So, I mean, just to put women front and center is accomplishment enough, but I think this accomplishes even more than that.
Out of your night and tribute for the theme, what's one movie that fans should definitely make time to either record or watch?
I think it's Little Annie Rooney. It's not one of my favorite Pickford movies per se, but the restoration is so pristine. The music is so great that it gives us our first opportunity in a long, long time to appreciate a Mary Pickford film in a way it should be seen. I'm so thrilled that after all these years of little YouTube snippets, you know, or DVDs out there that just weren't really cleaned up or had appropriate scores or, whatever, you know, or traditional scores that were just too heavy-handed. I mean, this is finally a, you know, as I say, a pristine restoration from Mary's own nitrate tinted print. It's a restoration that took several years to accomplish. So to be able to have that screened on TCM and give it the wider audience, I'm just thrilled because I've been part of that restoration the whole time and all the years and all the different entities that were involved in the process. And so to finally have that out, it was one of Mary's UA films. The entire film was filmed on the lot, which in and of itself is take your hats off to the set decorators. It's an incredible job. I mean, there's just many things about it, but for me, it's got that evening has to be taking nothing away from the other women. But film-wise, Little Annie Rooney is definitely the movie to see because it's the first chance in decades to see Mary as she's supposed to be seen.
What's on the horizon for you? And I know My First Time in Hollywood's been out for, over a year?
I guess a little over a year. I'm writing. I've got to put kibble in the bowl.
Exactly. Don't we all?
So it's my day job. So I've been writing, doing a lot of articles right now and finishing up a piece. I'm doing a foreword for a new book on articles on women screenwriters. I think I have about 5 open Word documents at the moment so that if I'm not working on this one, I'm working on that one. I mean, I have a book I'm working on Swanson and how actresses deal with aging.
That'll be a good read.
I'm working on that as well as these other things that, you know, it's a bit of a juggling act, but I love it. I'm very aware, you know, that I'm able to do it and what a rarity that is. I mean, I've worked very hard to be in this position, but at the same time, I'm very appreciative of it. To be asked by TCM to come back and to, you know, anchor the first night.
To hang out with Ileana Douglas, too.
And all the other, you know, the TCM people who are incredible. I mean, the crew, you know, you don't know that there were, I bet you 30 people altogether. If you count everybody, there's at least, you know, 15 active participants on the set between the lighting, the grips, the cameras, the et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, the producers and everything. So there was, you know, an awful lot going on behind the scenes. And most of it was filmed in Los Angeles, but I think they did, you know, one day in Atlanta, too.
But it all looks effortless. The viewers see a sweat.
Yes, well, that's true. I know. And you know you're in good hands. I mean, the TCM people are incredibly professional. And the other fun part is, I should tell you, is the overall is produced by a woman named Courtney Bryan. There's an awful lot of women. The crew is majority women. And that's exciting to see them in action. Always good to see. You know, you don't see that a lot.
No, not at all. Thank you so much for taking time out to chat with me today.
Oh, my pleasure. It's my favorite time of year. I love talking about this show.
It's great. I knew they were doing it for, 3 years? But I didn't know when it was going to be happening, so I am excited. The broadest question is, what defines a trailblazing woman for you?
All of these actresses that we are highlighting, and some of them who I grew up watching, is that I feel that, like, literally since the dawn of Hollywood, actresses have used their fame to nurture causes, to contribute, and to promote social change. And that's what I think of as a trailblazer. They never took no for an answer, like Betty Davis. They said things like, I owed it to my country, which is Myrna Loy, who gave up her career to support the war effort, and Marlene Dietrich, who was spent more time on the front lines than any other Hollywood star, Carol Lombard, who died in the service of our country. It's more than seeing Carol Lombard in 20th Century, even though that's an amazing film. It's to think, wow, you know, that to me is what a trailblazer is. And that goes all the way through somebody like Barbra Streisand, who was so talented in her own right that she could have simply rested on her laurels to be Barbra Streisand. But she has defined and taken a lot of hits for going out there and being a female director, being a feminist, supporting social causes. They're fearless, and they've caused the narrative to change. We're all benefiting by things that actresses have contributed to this country. And it, on the one hand, it may seem funny. It's like, really, Shirley Temple? But it's like, yeah, Shirley Temple.
Single-handedly saved the Depression, pretty much.
Exactly. And so in this context, with society moving so quickly, it's like somebody like Shirley Temple, to me, is, you know, she's a hero in the way, much more so, in my opinion, than a Charles Lindbergh. And, you know, we have statues to all sorts of men in this country that have contributed things. But Shirley Temple, you know, was credited by the president of generating, you know, hope and optimism. And she was a business person. She was handling licensing and merchandising, hundreds and hundreds of merchandising deals, products, and became the U.S. ambassador, was around during the Prague Spring. She was the first actress to speak out about her, you know, having a double mastectomy. If she had just had a career as a child actress, that would have been significant. I feel as if, again, just what's so amazing about the series and giving the chance to do this series is that there's a complacency, I feel, that we have. Like, yeah, she's an actress.
It's worth pointing out, Bette Davis was, you know, notoriously cited as being difficult, which is kind of the kiss of death for a lot of,
right,
of a lot of actresses. And I'm a huge Veronica Lake fan, who was partially rightfully so, but was labeled difficult to work with, and, you know, a bunch of men just didn't like working with her. And so it's great to see these actresses kind of come out, kind of point at that double standard through their film work, that, you know, maybe being difficult yields an enduring legacy.
I think so. I mean, because you can't watch the show. I mean, and this is what TCM does so well, in an entertaining narrative. I mean, so many times when I'm having conversations with someone like Rita Moreno, you know, who won an Academy Award for West Side Story and then didn't work for 12 years, couldn't find a role. And when we're discussing somebody like Josephine Baker or Lena Horne, who was working with Eleanor Roosevelt to end anti-lynching laws in America, you can't then watch her in a film and not think about that, for me anyway. It's, or you can't watch Lee Grant in Shampoo and forget what courage it took for her. You know, she was blacklisted. We're not even talking about, again, people recognizing the personal sacrifices that people made because they spoke out. They could have saved their careers. A lot of actors didn't speak out or name names, not Lee Grant.
Yeah, she's very, very vocal.
So it's recognizing, to me, and like really kind of embracing actresses and changing a narrative that it feels like we currently have.
When I was soliciting questions on Twitter, somebody asked, they wanted to ask you if you considered yourself a trailblazing woman, because
I certainly, in terms of my career, I made a decision at a certain point in the 90s that I wanted to work with women, that I wanted to spend the rest of my career, if I could, telling stories with a female point of view. And when, you know, the internet was sort of, I did doing web series, you know, way before it kind of became popular to do so. So in that sense, you know, I would say that that's give myself a little bit of a pat on the back for working with IKEA and doing that show and creating a successful online web series way before anybody else was doing it. And it was like, it took a lot of knocks to see the future. And I think that again, that's what a trailblazer does, is they don't take no for an answer. They see that somehow this is the future. And it's a narrative that's going to be good for everybody. And I think that that's where it's hard for women, is that they don't specifically get the credit I think that they deserve. I said this last year, it's like they blaze the trail for then the men's sake. Thank you very much for blazing that trail for us. Now, if you'll only step aside so we can make the big bucks.
Exactly. You can open the movie. You can make the first movie, and then we'll continue the franchise from here on out.
Yes, exactly. So I think that that's the thing that sticks in women's craw the most. You take the slings and arrows. Sometimes even when you make the movie, you make this through this adversity, and you make the movie, and it's successful, and then it doesn't get a sequel, or a man does the same thing and that becomes a big success. So those are the things that I think that by doing the show, and again, showing these actresses as three-dimensional people. I mean, so many amazing discussions that we had. But, you know, there's a discussion that we had, decision even to add Marilyn Monroe into the equation was a really fascinating conversation. It's always fun doing the show because of all the women involved and the discussions that we have, which are very inspiring because women have these diverse opinions. So when in discussing, you know, Marilyn Monroe and this idea that she created her own destiny and yet she was sort of destroyed by her own image becomes a really interesting narrative in terms of today, is that she was a producer on this movie, Prince and the Showgirl. I never knew she was a producer. I've seen the movie, and it's not until I was doing a show that I realized, like, she's a producer on this?
Yeah, people don't know that, like, she started a production company, and she read her, I don't know if it's possible or not, but she read Book a Day, and talking to somebody about comparing Marilyn to Madeline Kahn, and how those two actresses don't get a lot of respect because it's very easy to play dumb, quote-unquote, and make it look like that, if you're a woman at least, make it look like that's just how you are.
Her narrative was written by men. Norman Mailer, Billy Wilder.
Arthur Miller.
Yeah, Arthur Miller, of course. Tony Curtis, Laurence Olivier. She was unable, because she didn't live long enough, she was unable to tell her own story. And, I mean, on the same night where we discussed Marilyn Monroe, we talk about Mae West. Two of the actresses profiled, Shirley Temple and Mae West, both saved Paramount. Men didn't save Paramount. It was women. But Mae West, you know, she's equal to Charlie Chaplin in the sense that she writes, you know, she's producing, she's doing all of her own stuff. But as soon as she starts to become successful and powerful is when she runs into all these problems with censorship. And so, again, her film career is cut short. And now, in today's context, we don't talk about Mae West. You know, we have an image, even me, who's a film lover. When you don't see the person, you start to develop, it's kind of a creaky image. Yeah, it's probably old, creaky and old-fashioned. I'm watching these Mae West movies, and I'm like, she's incredible.
Exactly. There's a backlash, I think, to her now, with a lot of people saying, you know, because she made, what was it, Sextet in the 70s, and she was, you know, far older, and she wasn't supposed to do that because it was old, and people, men specifically, thought it was weird and gross, and it's just, it's ridiculous reading how things change after you're dead.
Yeah.
Well, I'm going to ask, because, you know, you've played some fantastic characters, whether it's Ghost World or Grace of My Heart, which is one of my favorites, or Factory Girl. When you're approaching projects, there's been a lot of talk on Twitter about, you know, how screenwriters and casting calls advertise for female roles. How's that been now? How's that journey been for you?
That doesn't exist anymore. The movies that I grew up watching, loving, whether it's like the women's films or films that my grandfather was in that I discovered, you know, which were romantic comedies, those are the ones that are closest to my heart, where the story is about the relationship of the male-female species or the mother-daughter dynamic. Or, you know, those are always the things that have fascinated me. So I always looked for those things in movies. But somewhere along the way, in the 90s, there was a backlash of women's roles started to be called like, oh, it's a chick flick, or, you know, it's targeted specifically towards women. And that may have been a mistake, because then it just became there were two separate audiences. And I almost feel like we have not recovered since whoever started marketing films to women and marketing films to men. And we still have this crazy narrative where if a movie comes out like, you know, First Wives Club, and it makes $200 million, it's called a surprise hit. And then if a movie comes out like, you know, the Bridesmaids movie, it's still called a surprising hit.
Who knew women could be funny? That's such a shock, apparently.
Yeah, so we're still using, and when I say we, it's the media or the collective we. You can make a study, because I did in my research, that every time, pretty much every time, a film comes out that stars women that does well, they call it a surprise. Now, why do they call it a surprise? Is it because it has women, or is it because we don't want any more movies like that? I don't know. That's undercurrent that I think that a female artist has to think of in this society. So when you're looking for a project, you're already thinking, oh God, it's got all women in it. This is really going to be a tough sell. And why am I thinking that? Maybe that's not even true, but that narrative has been, even I believe it, you know, because you read it so much. So maybe by doing this show, that'll start to change. But as a writer and a director myself, I can only tell stories from point of view. And we definitely went through, I think, in the past 10 years, some real dark ages. Hopefully we're coming out of them. You know, women are the ones who open the door and have three scenes in a movie. And it's like they're the angry wife, they're the supportive wife, the angry girlfriend, the supportive girlfriend. You have to have the ability to point out something. And again, I think that the reason I love doing the show is that the evidence and the films speak for themselves. Those of us who love TCM and watch TCM, especially those of us who are women, I think there's a part of us that watches these films because they have women in them. And it's really, really enjoyable to watch
Barbara
Stanwyck or Veronica Lake. And guess what? They're in the whole movie. The movie is about them. I happen to be watching Double Indemnity.
Amazing movie.
God, it's like an actress and as a writer, it gets your juices salivating, because you're like, God, she's so horrible. You know, like, you know, you're rooting for them, you hate them. Everything that it is an actress used on best of her abilities, working on all cylinders. What happens, I think that that's why we keep watching, again, these things in TCM, is that it inspires us to make those kind of movies and sort of pretend, well, I'm really not going to worry about the marketplace, even though it doesn't seem like many, I'm seeing women in the beginning, middle, and end of the film. It gives us hope that we can come back to that. But anyway, my long-winded point was that by showing all these films and these people, we're going to start to realize what we're missing as a society. That, to me, is the tragedy. Not only are we not getting to see enough women in films, but it's not reflecting society. And if we can't talk about a female role and why she did something or why she didn't do something, or that's not good, because how do we, as women, how do we learn about ourselves? I mean, I went to the movies when I was a kid. I remember being so inspired watching Jane Fonda in the film Julia. Gave me that pretend feeling that I could grow up and be a writer, or you could see Barbara Streisand in a movie and I'm like, I'm going to be like Barbara Streisand or Liza Minnelli. I mean, you know, I've written about this in my book, how many of these women just inspired me in the variety of roles that they did. And as they were exploring who they were, we were learning about ourselves. And what I wonder is, who are our next role models? You know, there was a cornucopia of women to choose from that I could be like if I wanted to. I mean, my mom and I remember it was like, yeah, going, my mom was a single mom, and we went to see an unmarried woman. It opened up a dialogue about being a single mom and what that was like. But if the women are just like in two scenes or three scenes, that's not good. You know, they're not three-dimensional. They're just there as a plot point.
Well, I have to throw out there, you know, is there an actress, a director that that would be a great person to interview on Trailblazing Women?
Well, I mean, of course, I really admire Ava DuVernay and all the work that she's doing. I'd love to speak to Gina Davis, Meryl Streep, of course, Susan Sarandon. We've profiled Susan Sarandon. Talking to Jane Fonda, it's an incredible experience. Jane Alexander. I mean, these are people that I watched in film. Barbara Streisand, of course, would be incredible. But somebody has to take up the mantle for them. And I wonder who that is going to be. There has to be the next generation. And again, actresses are not getting a long enough chance to have a significant body of work so that they become the fabric of our society, like Jane Fonda or Bette Midler. You know, I mean, again, Bette Midler was so much a part of my childhood, her sass and her musical comedy, and she wasn't traditionally beautiful, and yet she was in The Rose, and it was an amazing movie. And you would think, well, if she can be in a movie, then I can be in a movie. And now it's like, boy, every time an actress is in a movie, it's like, you don't want to read the review because you're just going to be like, how bad is it going to be?
Somebody did want to ask, because you are a frequent friend of the TCM Classic Film Festival. It's like for you to interact and introduce these amazing films at the festival. And if you know any insider information about next year.
No insider information. I'm on pins and needles like everybody else. I have to say that, again, it's, you know, and everybody feels this way, it's, for me, it's such a privilege. The highlight, of course, is getting to speak to people. Like, for instance, this past year, when I got to speak to Carl Reiner, and Carl Reiner's first professional job in show business was when my grandfather is a producer at the show called Call Me Mister, you know, cast him in a show coming out of the Army. And so to have that history with my grandfather, and then to get to interview somebody like Carl Reiner, who has just defined comedy, is such a privilege, you know, because I just feel that movies have been so instrumental in my life and in our society, that I consider it such a responsibility to ask best questions that I can, because I know from my point of view and from everybody in the audience how privileged everybody feels to be there, to be in the company of a Gina Lollobrigida, or, you know, Carl Reiner, Mel Brooks, or any of these people. And I think of the first year when I was there, and I mean, I met Tony Curtis, you know, like, I'm like a kid. I just, as our society has less and less real, honest to God movie stars, you have to feel that they sprinkle a little stardust on you.
Definitely that moment where it's a huge film festival, but moments feel so intimate there.
I agree. One of the highlights for me wasn't even interviewing anyone. It was sitting in the Cinerama Dome watching It's a Mad, 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 Mad World in 70mm and laughing my ass off with my friend. It was a packed audience, enjoying that film, watching the film the way it was supposed to be. It was like eating a tub of ice cream. I'll have that memory for the rest of my life. So for those of us that love movies, it is like you have those moments there where you're like, yes, this is that feeling.
I did All That Heaven Allows last year, which Allison Anders introduced, and if memory serves, you were there. You popped in for a little bit.
Yes.
I had never seen that before, and I went at 9 a.m. Nobody wanted to go with me because it was too early. And I went and I saw it, and that movie is just fantastic. But it's moments like that where, you know, if you're going to see a film for the first time, that's pretty much like the perfect way to go see it.
Right.
Last question, since I don't want us to run over too much. Is there a specific night or a specific theme that you love for this Trailblazing Women that fans should definitely make time to either DVR or watch live? Or
that is so tough.
Obviously, they should watch the whole theme.
I would say to watch the series in its entirety, which is what people did last year, tells a narrative story. So it's always good to be a part of that, because again, we want not just like, okay, tonight's host is Rita Moreno. We tell a narrative that begins Carrie Beecham, who's a film. So it gives us a context of the history. And then we just start loading the deck with, let's talk about war effort. Let's talk about philanthropy. Let's talk about Elizabeth Taylor giving a face to AIDS. Let's talk about activism. So it becomes this enriching experience to watch the entire show. That being said, speaking to Lee Grant, you know, who again worked with my grandfather, and when we were going to be talking about the actresses that were blacklisted, specifically the actress Dorothy Cumming Gore, and watching the film Citizen Kane, which I've seen 20, 30 times, but I never knew the narrative of what happened to Dorothy Cumming Gore because of the blacklist. And, you know, her life was destroyed because she was in that film. And there is no other reason that her life was destroyed other than her being cast in the film Citizen Kane and her not being happy about it. And it feels as if that her performance and her life really deserved more than that. I mean, she died in poverty and obscurity and went mad, and her children were taken away from her, and she was set up by the police and arrested on a false charge of prostitution. I mean, then this happened. This happened because she played a character in a movie. And it was such a tragedy. And Lee Grant said to me that we have to tell, I'm here as a survivor of the blacklist to tell these women's stories. These stories have to be told. And that, for me, rose above the entire entertainment value of the show. That was real. You know, people's lives were ruined. People died. Could be in that place again, which is something that we talk about with the political climate of today. If we want to suddenly target someone, we can do it. So it creates a kind of a scary discussion amongst the very, very poignant talking to Lee Grant. That was an incredible night.
Thank you so much, Ileana, for talking to me today. I'm so excited for Trailblazing Women and to see you and all of that. I'm so excited. So thank you so much.
Thank you.
Once again, I'd like to thank Carrie Beecham and Ileana Douglas. It was fantastic to get to talk to them about this amazing series. That closes out this edition of Ticklish Business. You can listen to Ticklish Business a multitude of ways, either at ticklishbusiness.podbean.com, via Stitcher Radio, or on iTunes. If you listen via iTunes, please feel free to leave a rating and review. It greatly helps the show's status. As always, you can contact me directly at ticklishbiz, that's B-I-Z, at gmail.com, or visit me at my official site where I discuss classic films regularly, journeysinclassicfilm.com. Especially if you're a Halloween nut, you're going to want to go over there because I have been doing my daily tribute to the Universal Horror franchise as well as other horror films I have probably had for far too long, but, you know, they need to be reviewed anyway. The podcast is also on Twitter at ticklish_biz, so feel free to tweet me your suggestions, questions, comments, what have you. Next time in our regular episode, I'll be talking with Todd Liebenow about the Frankenstein series. We're specifically going to be talking about James Whale's Frankenstein, Bride of Frankenstein, as well as Son of Frankenstein. And if you have TCM, be sure to tune in every Sunday this month, because Frankenstein is their monster of the month. Until next time, everybody.